This is an ABC podcast.
Good morning. Welcome to AM. I'm Sabra Lane. Across the country, builders are going broke, leaving people with unfinished homes and big debts and thousands of workers without jobs. Builders are losing money because the fixed price contracts they previously agreed to are ending up well below what it costs for materials and labour. There are fears the situation could get worse, as Nassim Kadem reports.
As builders go under, the dreams of would-be homeowners like Donna Taylor get shattered.
It's massive. It's heartbreaking. I'll be out of pocket $180,000 just to finish the build.
She was left with a rotting timber frame at her property in San Remo in Victoria's Gippsland region when Langford Jones Homes collapsed at the end of June, owing millions of dollars. The 53-year-old is now working two jobs and paying a mortgage as well as rent until another builder can finish the job.
There's so many more people that are like me that it's just ruined and just feel like there's just no justice. I've just wasted 2 years waiting and I don't have the house that I wanted.
Since the end of last year, the list of builders going under has been growing as people rush to build more homes, fuelled by pandemic support measures, labour costs jumped and prices for materials, including steel and timber, rose by more than 40%. Gold Coast developer and co-founder of ASX-listed Sunland Group, Sahel Abadian, feels the building collapses have just started.
I believe the second tier, third tier construction company will be very vulnerable. And I think the first tier construction company, they will survive, although maybe the margin will be smaller than what they thought it will be.
And with the benefit of 40 years' experience, he thinks the construction industry's woes have been driven by greed.
Everybody would like to have more and more profit. And for that, they increase the prices without understanding that ultimately it will backfire on every single part of the industry.
Harry Triggerboff, who's the founder of the large private developer Meriton, believes rising interest rates could cause further industry chaos.
I hope that as many as possible will remain. And I hope they learn not to work on such small margins. That is my advice to them.
Back in Victoria, the founder of Langford Jones Homes, Bruce Langford Jones, says consumers affected by the company's collapse are covered by warranty insurance. But Donna Taylor says she's only covered for 20% of the original contract price and she's been left out of pocket because the cost to build has increased so much.
I just wish there was more out there to protect us, some sort of governing body that kept an eye, a closer eye on businesses before they went into all this debt, because it just doesn't seem right that we have to cop the brunt of it.
That's Victorian homeowner Donna Taylor ending that report from Nassim Kadem. Almost every day we're hearing about industries struggling to find skilled workers, and electricians are no different. Sparkies are on the federal government's list of the most in-demand professions, and unions and industry groups say one of the reasons for that is the high rate of people dropping out of their electrical apprenticeships. Gavin Coote reports.
Carlin was eager to follow her father's footsteps and take up a career as an electrician. She's now a fourth-year apprentice on the New South Wales Central Coast.
I work on the electrical network and I'm with an overhead section at the moment, which means I get to do really fun jobs like putting up cross arms and changing poles.
While she has few regrets, Carlin's found it difficult to cover the bills on her apprentice wage and says others have dropped out because they're not getting enough financial and mentoring support.
Depending on whether you get a really good employer or not so good employer can really affect the outcome of your apprenticeship. As an apprentice, cost of living is a really big challenge, especially going through COVID and all these inflations that have been coming through. It's becoming harder and harder to support ourselves throughout our apprenticeship.
The growing demand for electricians and the relatively low completion rate among apprentices has many in the industry worried. Larry Moore is with the National Electrical and Communications Association, which represents electrical contractors.
I must say that the attrition rates of apprentices across Australia is pretty awful. I know I did a survey a couple of years ago. We're in South Australia. I think the completion rate was about 68% for electrical apprentices. which is it's a massive investment.
Larry Moore points out the need for more electricians is going to grow as the nation moves to renewable energy.
That is an emerging problem that's probably bigger than everything. The electrification of the industry, and particularly with renewable energy, etc., is going to be massive. Getting people up to speed on that and getting new people into the industry is going to be critical because it is a massive change coming.
The Australian Energy Market Operator is predicting an extra 12,500 skilled workers will be needed for large-scale renewable energy projects within 5 years. Unions aren't feeling hopeful about that happening. Michael Wright is Acting Secretary of the Electrical Trades Union.
We're talking about the trades and skills that we so desperately need for all of the work that is coming down the pipeline in connection with renewable energy coming online, in connection with people getting electric vehicles, electric cooktops, all of this work. We have such an enormous need for electrical workers over the next 10 to 20 years.
Michael Wright thinks more needs to be done to encourage apprentices to finish their training. His union's releasing a survey today of more than 600 electrical apprentices, which found almost 40% have considered quitting.
The government is well aware of the need to train a lot more electrical apprentices. They've already announced 10,000 energy apprentices. But of course, what we need is 10,000 energy apprentices finishing, not 10,000 energy apprentices starting and 48% of those dropping out.
In a statement, the Skills and Training Minister, Brendan O'Connor, says given the decline in apprenticeship completion rates over the last decade, targeted, high-quality and effective mentoring is critical to see apprentices through to completion. He says next week's Jobs and Skills Summit will be an opportunity to discuss innovative ways to improve the quality of apprenticeships.
Gavin Coote reporting there. An influx of Indonesian fishing boats poaching in Australian waters is being partly blamed on poverty and inflation, worsened by the pandemic. Fishing authorities say they're seeing the highest number of illegal fishing boats in waters bordering Indonesia since 2006, and they're taking tons of Australian seafood species in the process. Correspondent Anne Barker visited the Indonesian island where many of the fishermen come from.
At Hundi Hook on the island of Roti, Mei Jinafi prays at an empty grave in her own front yard. She's now a widow since her husband and captain, Johannes Balu, drowned at sea with 8 crew members in March while fishing in waters off Australia's northwest coast. Their bodies were never found despite an intensive search and rescue operation involving the Australian Navy. The custom here is when someone dies at sea, we have a grave to remember him by, she says, so the children and grandchildren know he drowned. 3 other crews survived after clinging to debris for days before they were rescued and taken to hospitals in Darwin and Perth with dehydration and hypothermia. It was one of the worst fishing tragedies in the seas north of Australia in years. I'm too scared to go back, says one survivor, Habel Kanuk. The risk is too high. It was a loss of income from COVID that forced the men to go to sea in the first place. Most of them had no experience as sailors. As Indonesia emerges from the pandemic and 2 years of near lockdown, thousands more men and teenagers, often with little experience on a boat, are trying to earn an income from fishing. At Hundi Hook alone, one of many small villages on Roti, closest to Australia, more than 100 fishermen have left in recent months, fueling a surge in illegal fishing boats in Australian waters. On a good day, we could take home over ₹1 million, says Melky Geary. If we just relied on farming, we'd only earn an income once a year. In the 12 months to June, Australian authorities say there were 44 fishing boats seized and almost 300 forced to leave, most of them Indonesian. It's a fourfold increase from the year before.
We haven't experienced these numbers for 10 to 15 years.
And Peter Van Slovis at the Australian Fisheries Management Authority says rising prices for fish and other marine species and a relative abundance of fish stocks in Australian waters are also key factors. And 29 tonnes of tripang or sea cucumber and almost 600 kilograms of shark have been seized.
Fishers who have previously held employment in the tourism industry and so forth, with the shutdowns and lockouts and so forth, they've had to find their way back to their home ports and look at other ways of making a living.
And authorities on Rote fear with so many Indonesians heading towards Australia's fishing zone, the number of men caught or who drown will also rise. This is Anne Barker in Rote for AM.
Australia's new Air Force chief says surveillance missions will continue in the South China Sea despite a recent series of confrontations with the Chinese military. Here's defence correspondent Andrew Green.
In the skies above Australia's top end, up to 100 military aircraft from across the globe have arrived for exercise pitch black. Almost 2,500 personnel are taking part in various training activities. At the same time in Canberra, Australia's new Air Force Chief, Air Marshal Robert Chipman, has been hosting the visiting US Air Force Secretary, Frank Kendall, for top-level talks.
Very much a two-way street. We depend upon our partners just as much as they depend upon us in any number of ways.
An area of increasing cooperation is the South China Sea, where Australia continues to conduct maritime surveillance patrols. Air Marshal Robert Chipman.
To maintain the status quo, to preserve the what we understand to be a rules-based global order, and to exercise our freedoms under international law. We have, and they're well-publicised, experienced recent encounters with the Chinese, which have been robust, to say the least.
Earlier this year, Defence revealed a Chinese J-16 fighter aircraft had conducted a dangerous intercept of an RAAF surveillance plane in the international airspace claimed by Beijing. The Air Force chief has confirmed there's been a recent spate of unsafe incidents involving the Chinese and warns the militarisation of the region is profound.
So we think that China has a formidable air and space capability, and that they have concentrated that air and space capability in the South China Sea region to deter others from going into that airspace. It doesn't make it impenetrable, and it doesn't mean that you can't deliver military effects to achieve your interests when you're operating against China.
It's a view shared by his American guest.
We're obviously all concerned about Chinese behaviour in the region, and that includes what they've done to develop the South China Sea and to militarise it. It includes what happened recently around Taiwan.
Despite the recent confrontations, Air Marshal Chipman says Australian patrols will continue, and he's urged the People's Liberation Army to adhere to international law and practices.
We see the Chinese as an incredibly capable modern military. What should follow is high standards of professionalism. And we would like to see the same standards of professionalism from the Chinese that we extend to them.
Air Marshal Robert Chipman ending Andrew Green's report. A Perth family's hoping an inquest starting tomorrow will finally answer crucial questions about the death of their daughter. The 7-year-old died from a bacterial infection last year after waiting for 2 hours at Perth's Children's Hospital. Her parents raised concerns multiple times while they were there, but were ignored, as Isabel Masali reports.
It's been more than a year since Aishwarya Ashworth's death, and the toll on her family is significant.
She has an older sister who is struggling with coming to terms with it all. The two younger boys have, on occasions when I've been there, asked when Aishwarya is coming home. And it's something that they are finding difficult to come to terms with.
Suresh Rajan is a friend of the 7-year-old's parents, Aswath Shavadapara and Prasita Sashidharan. Ahead of a highly anticipated 2-week coronial inquest, he says they're struggling, but they desperately want to know what went wrong on April the 3rd at Perth's Children's Hospital.
Just so that they have some closure as to exactly what happened to their 7-year-old daughter on that night. If they can get that, they will walk away from the inquest knowing that they have at least understood what it is that caused her death. To this day, they have a few suppositions, but nothing definitive as to exactly what transpired on that night.
Since Aishwarya's death, her parents have been determined to get answers and change.
We lost our child, and this shouldn't happen to anybody else. That's the main thing we want.
I keep saying the same thing. What I'm doing now, if somebody had done, this one in the past, I would have had my daughter with me right now.
They went on a hunger strike, and a protest at Perth's Children's Hospital attracted thousands of angry hospital workers. There have been internal and external reviews finding a cascade of missed opportunities, but only 6 of the 30 recommendations from the external inquiry have been fully implemented so far. Family spokesperson Suresh Rajan again.
And that's the concern that the family also has. Why has this not occurred? Why has, you know, so little been given to make all of those recommendations reality and put them into place right now? The family doesn't want any other parent to have to go through what they've gone through.
Janet Ray is the State Secretary of the Nurses Federation. She's seen an improvement in staffing levels at Perth's Children's Hospital, but says it's not enough.
These people have gone to work to do a job. The system is letting them down badly, and they're unable to do their job safely or adequately. So really, the government needs to wake up and look at what's going on and not tell everyone that we're coping and everything's hunky-dory. It's not.
In a statement, the WA Health Minister, Amber Jade Sanderson, says the government will carefully consider all recommendations of the coronial inquest.
Isabel Masali reporting. Should newly built homes be accessible for elderly people who are frail or people with a disability? Aged and disability advocates certainly think so, and they're urging a meeting of housing ministers on Friday to push for agreement on national accessible building standards. But as Annie Guest reports, at least 3 states have already opted out.
Jacob Darkin was a 21-year-old tradesman when his life changed dramatically.
I was at a food market in Penrith, and I was with my girlfriend at the time, and I was just mucking around.
He was trying an acrobatic trick he'd been practicing.
It was in 2019 when I broke my neck. I did a front flip and I've got a spinal cord injury. I spent 9 months in hospital and I learned how to do everything again. I learned how to dress myself and get back into the community.
Now the apartment he rents, which has wheelchair access, is being sold.
I'm getting a bit worried because I've just been told I have about 30 days if this buyer does come through to find somewhere to move into, and I don't really know where to go.
And he says his options are limited.
And usually it says that it's accessible, but I'll find that there's a walk-in shower.
That's echoed by Karen Appleby from the Council on the Ageing, who says 3 out of 4 people with mobility problems can't find a suitable home. She wants a meeting of federal, state and territory housing ministers on Friday to advance the rollout of accessibility features for new buildings.
So it can range from as simple as having a little bit of a wider doorway through to having some space in a kitchen, around a kitchen bench, to having one step-free entrance into the home.
Last year, New South Wales, Western Australia and South Australia opted out of proposed changes to the National Construction Code to make it mandatory for new homes to have minimum accessibility standards.
But it's not just for people that are older or with disability. It's for anyone who might have an accident during their life, might have an illness, and they still need to enter their home or visit someone else. We've heard so many stories of families not being able to have relatives visit them. They feel that that family member is excluded.
But the Property Council's chief executive, Ken Morrison, says it's more economical to only build certain houses to be accessible, particularly at a time when the building industry is under pressure.
The regulatory impact statement, which was done in 2021 against these changes, found that the costs outweighed the benefits by at least $4 billion over 10 years.
And what about the argument that accessible homes allow people to have visitors and allow people with disability to visit?
Well, again, that is the case, but what you need is to weigh up the costs and the benefits.
So what does that mean for Friday's meeting then?
Well, at the very least, we'd like to see a delay in implementation.
Ken Morrison from the Property Council ending Annie Guest's report. That's AM for today. Thanks for your company. I'm Sabra Lang.
Hi,
G'day, I'm Sam Hawley, host of the ABC News Daily podcast. 6 months ago this week, the world was shocked as Vladimir Putin waged his war on Ukraine. As the first explosions rang out around the country, we spoke to Ukrainian resident Olga Polotska and to former Russia resident and expert Samuel Green. Today we catch up with them again. Look for the ABC News Daily podcast on the ABC Listen app.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.